Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting through our studios in New York City, but not video streaming because today is another day of filming, and I'll discuss that filming a little later on in our program. We're going to talk about a new study showing that acupuncture actually beats injected morphine for pain and how low vitamin D levels are linked to an increased risk of bladder cancer, University of Warwick. And also a new study shows that astaxanthin is effective against daily mental and physical fatigue. That's important. And how Georgia State University is now showing us a common food additive promotes colon cancer. That's not good, but we should know about it. And the mother's vitamin B12 levels is important because it can help reduce the child's risk of developing diabetes. And bee propolis has some surprising health benefits, yet the average person doesn't even know what it is and how to use it. We'll get to that. And lycopene and lutein show skin protection against ultraviolet radiation. And this is from the Research Institute for Environmental Medicine in Germany. And more, including music therapy, reducing depression in children and adolescents. Then today, no guest. Instead, I'm going to offer some opportunities for you to call in at the latter part of our program after I've shared my own commentary. Today's commentary was spurred by what I read concerning Rachel Maddow now blaming Jill Stein and the million people who voted for her and Gary Johnson and the about 4 million people who voted for him. And these are the people who caused Hillary Clinton to lose. Fair enough. Michael Moore is starting a whole campaign today about why we should take back the Democratic Party. And he means it. Good. And one of the spiritual leaders of the world, at least that's what I'm told, says that maybe I should rethink any more challenges to Hillary Clinton. Fair enough. I can accept that. So I'm going to share my own commentary on all this. And then from Jake Johnson, from Common Dreams, blame the neoliberals. Democrats' toxic ideology paved the way for Trump. Oh, and I have a quote from Bernie Sanders today that you have not heard, didn't know existed. And I'm going to share that with you. I think many of you will be very optimistic when you hear Bernie Sanders, quote, build an independent democratic socialist left. All right, I'll share that with you. And then what do you think of this? What do you think if the people on the left and the MSNBC and CNN, they generally go through a period of anger, frustration, disappointment, understandably so, when their anointed one loses. And there'll be a sense of grieving and loss, but it won't be 3 days of grieving at this loss and then ascension to a higher moral place. There'll be about 3 weeks of grieving loss, and then you'll start to see accolades upon accolades of this brave, progressive idealist who really should have been nominated for either a Nobel Peace Prize or for Humanitarian of the Year Award. Well, at least that's what a lot of people are suggesting. I'll offer some of my own insights on that. So you see, we have a lot coming. Now, if time permits, I want to give you some of the real insight into the media's not covering the oil companies' challenge to the indigenous people's rights of their land. A real philosopher and a real spiritualist, Bertrand Russell's advice for future generations. This was over 60 years ago. He's made this short statement. And what does the Trans-Pacific Partnership mean for you? You thought it was over? It's not over. Not at all. And then, when we talk about the gifted ones and positions of power, and after all, they must be gifted. We're not there. They are. Who better to give us insights than George Carlin? When it comes to the every person's Illuminati, we'll understand that. So I think you'll find today's program, at the very least, insightful. We always begin with the latest on health and healing. There's a new study that shows, quote, an amazing new study has found that acupuncture, the ancient practice of using needles to stimulate body self-healing, is more effective than intravenous morphine for pain. Think of all the people who have pain and also are debilitated and are in the end stages of life. People with terminal cancers, really bad cancers that are very painful, like pancreatic cancer. Now, here's the catch-22. If you give them too much morphine, they virtually lose all cognition. They won't feel pain, but they're unaware of who you are, where they're at. They're just in a space waiting to die. Then we think, well, what else will work? Well, now this is showing, how about acupuncture? And I'll go two steps forward beyond that. What if you were to give them some real anti-pain, natural, non-toxic remedies, such as cat's claw? That really helps with pain. Black cumin seed oil also is very powerful with pain. Evening primrose oil helps as well. Those are known natural, along with cayenne, high heat units, 40,000 to 60,000 units. These can help diminish it. And now on top of that, add in acupuncture. Now you can see people actually overcoming their pain and have enough cognition that without the pain, they're willing to continue the fight. From the University of Warwick, that's in England, they took a look at a study on vitamin D. What happens if you do not have enough of it, if you're deficient? Quote, you're at increased risk of bladder cancer. This is published in the Society of Endocrinology. And what they found is that you need the vitamin D. You need it every day. We get it when we're exposed to sunshine, and the body helps control calcium and phosphate levels. And vitamin D can be gotten from, well, from fish, but also from kale, from seaweed, from sesame seeds. Plenty of good vegan sources to get it from. And if you get enough, then you're going to be protected in your cardiovascular system, your cognition system. You'll have better cognition. You'll have less autoimmune conditions, less cancer. That is what this is showing. One more reason to have a very inexpensive, non-invasive test done that determines, do you have enough vitamin D? You don't need a lot, 5,000 units a day. A new study shows that astaxanthin is effective against mental and physical fatigue. This is based upon a group of Chinese scientists. They published their Journal of Clinical Therapeutics Medicine article. This was a double-blind, placebo-controlled, 8-week study, and they found that when you're taking in this important nutrient, you're improving mental health and physical health and overcoming fatigue. That's good. It wasn't a lot either, just 20 milligrams. That's a small amount. That would be the low end of what I would recommend. I generally recommend 20 to 30 milligrams 2 to 3 times a day. So even at the smallest dose, they found an improvement. Now, what if you suffer from chronic fatigue syndrome? What if you're suffering from fatigue and muscle pain because of Lyme's disease? So if you were taking 3 times a day, you would be better able to function, less pain, and less fatigue. So the results suggest that astaxanthin supplementation has beneficial effects on fatigue encountered in daily life. Good. That was a double-blind study. A common food additive promotes colon cancer in this study. This is from Georgia State University, published in Cancer Research. What it says is this, something we never discuss, emulsifiers. Now, what are emulsifiers? These are chemicals that are added to most processed foods to aid in the texture and extend the shelf life. But also we found out now they can adversely interfere with the bacteria in your intestines, which cause inflammation and increase your colorectal cancer risk. Which, by the way, colorectal cancer, which is completely preventable with high-quality fibers, get rid of dairy and sugars and meat, but it's now the fourth leading cause of cancer-related deaths worldwide. 700,000 people died in just one recent year of colorectal cancer. But also we now know that the microbiota, which is the key good bacteria that helps prevent Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, ileitis, diverticulitis, and inflammatory bowel conditions from exacerbating. And because once those get exacerbated, you end up with what is known as colon tumorigenesis, and that's associated with cancer. And this is from low-grade infections. That's what happens when you have coffee and soft drinks. You create low-grade infections in the esophagus, in the stomach, and in the intestines. Then you have meat in the diet. Now you're more likely to have colorectal cancer. So these emulsifiers that are used in food to hold it together, to bind it together, they're a contributing factor. One more reason to go more natural. Get rid of those emulsifiers. And also, a pregnant woman's vitamin B12 level should be adequate for her and her developing fetus. If it is, according to the Society for Endocrinology's annual conference, you can help prevent type 2 diabetes in that child. So you don't need a lot of B12, about 600 micrograms to maybe 1 milligram. And that'll make a difference. And finally, bee propolis. I remember bee propolis because my great aunt, the only one in my family who seemed to know anything about food, nutrition, gardening, she always had a jar of it. And it was black, gooey. It reminded me of my brother was a car jockey. And that's what we called him back then. He had a group of friends, and these guys were so good at cars. They lived for cars. They looked for the challenge of fixing a car up, making hot rods, and they had the coolest cars ever, and they were all masters of what they did. There is nothing about a car that they couldn't fix, figure out, and they loved it. And they were always, their hands were greasy, their whole bodies were greasy, and that's what that reminded me of. Is that bee propolis and this grease. Well, it tasted terrible too. It tasted as bad as it looked. So nobody ever wanted it near them. When they got a cold, they would take a cough drop, did nothing for the cold, and she would come in if she saw that I was starting to get a cold, and she would give me a teaspoon of bee propolis with some honey, I don't know what kind of honey, and some lemon juice that she would squeeze, because I'll watch her squeeze lemon juice in this tea. I don't know what kind of tea it was. I think it was sassafras, but I'm not sure. And she'd say, you drink this 3 times in a day, and I would. And then she would put this really smelly stuff. It was a Vicks vapor rub on my chest. It was kind of mentholated, and next day I was fine. Now today, you look back and she said, well, what was she doing? Well, she was using one of the world's most powerful natural antibiotics. It is phenomenal. Bee propolis begins as a resin secreted by trees. And bees metabolize it. And then the resulting substance is about 30% bee wax and 55% resins and 10% aromatic oils and ethers. It is responsible for creating a sterile, safe environment within beehives. So if you want to see healthy bees, you have to understand that those bees are exposed to all forms of toxins, genetically engineered crops and insects, and then when they're sprayed, their immune systems become weak, their navigational signals are messed up, and you have colony collapse. Well, I'm a beekeeper. I have right now about 14 hives. I've had as many as about 150. Never once have I had bee colony collapse. I teach courses in how people should maintain the beehive. I don't take the bee honey for myself. It's not meant for me or you. It's meant for the bee, especially in bad weather, especially in the 6 months a year where there may not be any pollination going on. There's no plant blooming. It's winter. It's snowy. So what's the bee supposed to eat? They give this garbage, this glucose water, which of course speeds up the death of the bees. Now, you would think that people who have hundreds of thousands of bees, millions of bees, lots of hives, would know this. They don't. And they travel them long distances. They starve them when they get there. They pollinate them, put them back on trucks. No, if you have bees, you take the honey and you store it for them. And then as they need it, you put it every day in a dish and watch. They'll wait for you. They'll wait. They know what time you're coming. You get there. You pour it in. 2 hours later, you go back. You pour more in. 2 hours later, you go back. You pour more in. All day long, they're eating that because that's their food. And then you put big bales of hay up in a box 3 feet above the hive, but far enough back from the hive so that when the wind comes, they don't get a wind chill factor. And so therefore, they're not killing off all their drones who are protecting the rest of the hive by allowing their bodies to freeze at night so that the queen won't die inside. Anyhow, inside the hive, they take the bee propolis and they line it so that it protects them. That's the whole purpose of bee propolis. Enormously powerful. But let's say that you need it. Okay, what can it do? Here's what we now know from good quality science that bee propolis can do. Propolis is P-R-O-P-O-L-I-S. It can kill cancer cells. That is correct. There are numerous types of cancer, including prostate and colon cancer, that it's able to kill. It creates what is called necrosis. Unlike chemotherapy, propolis also only targets cancer cells, never healthy cells. It gives you healthier bones. It suppresses the inflammatory response. It halts bone deterioration. It's great for food poisoning. In fact, if you mix charcoal with bee propolis and aloe vera, that flushes out and heals and turns off inflammation of all forms of food poisoning out of the gut. Staphylococcus aureus, enterobacteria, it kills them. It reduces inflammation from your teeth to your gums to your arteries to your brain. It lowers blood pressure. Why? Because of nitric oxide, nitric, N-I-T-R-I-C, which is crucial for your healthy heart and very good in the enzymes, the TH enzymes, the tyrosine hydroxylase, which can limit its production. It removes warts, and it's good for allergies, and it helps with the common cold. So there you have the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I think we need a moment from George Carlin just to keep our heads on straight and keep people having a little different perspective when you hear someone as insightful as George talk about our society.
But there's a reason. There's a reason. There's a reason for this. There's a reason education. And it's the same reason that it will never, ever, ever be fixed. It's never going to get any better. Don't look for it. Be happy with what you got. Because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now. The big wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. Forget the politicians. Politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media companies, so they control just about all of the news and information you get to hear. They got you by the... They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. You know something? They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table to figure out how badly they get by a system that threw them overboard years ago. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers. People who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your retirement money. They want it back so they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They'll get it all from you sooner or later because they own this place. It's a big club, and you ain't in it. You and I are not in the big club. And by the way, it's the same big club they used to beat you over the head with all day long when they tell you what to believe. All day long, beating you over the head in their media, telling you what to believe, what to think, and what to buy. The table is tilted, folks. The game is rigged, and nobody seems to notice. Nobody seems to care. Good, honest, hardworking people, white collar, blue collar, doesn't matter what color shirt you have on. Good, honest, hardworking people continue. These are people of modest means. Continue to elect these rich girls who don't give about them. They don't about you. They don't give about you. They don't care about you at all, at all, at all. Man. You know? And nobody seems to notice, nobody seems to care. That's what the owners count on, the fact that Americans will probably remain willfully ignorant of the big red pills every day. Because the owners of this country know the truth. It's called the American dream, because you have to be asleep to believe it.
Now, as far as President-to-be Trump, this is something I think we should understand. His cabinet represents his think tank, because I believe most of us, myself included, would say that he's a functional illiterate. He's not smart. He has no sense of history, nor of irony, nor of manners, nor of decency. He could, but he has succeeded without them, so why go back and get something that you didn't need? Not in the game that he plays in. So on a regular basis, once he has made his selection for any government post, my team of scholars will bring you, on that day, the real background of the person he's hired, because the person he's hiring and putting in the position, Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary of Energy, that person is the one who is smart enough to know what business wants and how that position can help them. Now, this was true for all of Obama's appointments, including Hillary Clinton. Well, by the way, you probably have never heard this, but I have confirmation from this through WikiLeaks, that Hillary Clinton was actually first going to be Vice President Clinton. Didn't know about that, but then was vetted out because of things in her background. In any case, when it comes to, for example, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, or Rudy Giuliani, or Bid Carson, or Newt Gingrich, or Florida Governor Rick Scott, and former Alaskan Governor Sarah Palin. These are some of the more high-profile individuals on his short list for appointees. We'll tell you about why that should be very concerning to all of you. And then we'll get into the retired General Michael Flynn being considered to head to Homeland Security, and John Bolton, that's a scary thought, heading anything. And yet he might be Secretary of State. The Attorney General, do you really want Christie or Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi or Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions or Giuliani as Attorney General? Do you want Secretary of Commerce to be Lou Eisenberg and or Mike Huckabee or David Perdue? I don't. In fact, none of the positions of people being considered now do I feel any have any true qualifications to do anything that would be meaningful for the rest of America. But boy, these would be very smart decisions for those in power. So once again, the entire Obama administration's top appointees were given to him by a person from Citigroup, and he took every one of those names because these represented what the Business Roundtable wanted, and he got them those jobs. They in turn brought in their people, so then now you have a cabal of at least In the neighborhood of 3,000 to 4,000 people working all told in government agencies who are not there working on our behalf. They're working on their behalf. Hillary Clinton had the same list of people. And these are the same people that have been in her former husband's administration, in George Bush's administration, and Barack Obama's administration. Nothing changes. So when George Carlton is saying nothing changes, you're not in their club, he is right. So will we finally grow up, mature enough to realize that both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party have betrayed all basic principles that they may have at one time represented something legitimate they don't any longer? Let me just give you one example. I'm filming, and I'm rushing to finish it after 7 years of working on it, my new documentary on how can we as individuals save the planet. I do not anticipate the government participating because no government has. No administration has actively implemented anything that represents keeping the gas and the oil and the nuclear fissionable materials in the ground and putting its money in real renewables, the most powerful and the most broad-based renewables be solar, the new generation, and wind power, not above-ground wind power, but wave power under the waters. And yet we're given nothing to that. Geothermal, nothing to that. This is the latest from Common Dreams. Quote, greenhouse gases are rising so fast that it could soon be game over for the climate, a leading scientist warned in response to a new study published yesterday that finds the planet could be heading for more than 7 degrees warming within our lifetimes. The study published in the journal Science Advances reported the United Nations' most accurate estimates on the, quote, the business-as-usual rate of global warming may be grossly, vastly underestimated. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, recently estimated that continuing to use fossil fuels at current rates, which, by the way, would have happened under Obama, did, his clean coal, Trump, it will, clean coal, and also clean energy, nuclear, clean coal, and clean gas hydrofracking from Hillary Clinton. So it doesn't matter who you put in power. Democrat or Republican is irrelevant. The people who behind the scenes are financing everything will make sure that in your lifetime, their industries don't have to comply or change. But it's no longer the range they told us. It's no longer 2.6 degrees increase. It is 7.3 degrees increase. Now, how bad is that? Later today, I'll be filming someone, and tomorrow out in Canada, I'm going to be filming a professor there, and who is probably the world's leading authority on what happens if we go up one more degree. And he has already told me in pre-interviews that if we get to 2.3 degrees, you'll see most of the species in the world over 30 pounds die. You'll see at least half of the United States be uninhabitable within the next 10 years. And it gets a lot worse, but I won't go into that now. But here's now they're saying this. And this is a group of scientists from University of Hawaii, University of Washington, University of Albany, Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. All of them are saying that it's now going to be 4.78 to 7.3. Well, here's the catch-22. They say this will be in with our lifetime. If we get to 5 degrees, you won't have any in our lifetime. That'll end life as we know it on the planet by at least 80%. So we're not talking about the future. We're not talking about 80 years from now. We're talking about the next 20 years. More on that. So what will happen? Trump did exactly what you expect. He brought into to talk about the environment and head up his Department of Energy with a corporate shill who does not believe in global warming. So much for that. So what can we make of this? Well, I think we could take a lesson from Jake Johnson from Common Dreams. Here's what he says. Congratulations are not in order. Donald Trump's bigotry, his heinous treatment of women, his authoritarian posturing, his hatred for free speech, and his stupendous ignorance are more than sufficient to make him a figure worthy of unqualified contempt. And now he's president. In the coming months, Trump will attempt to impose himself on the country, and the state of the countervailing forces is hardly reassuring. Republicans are abhorrent, and Democrats are feckless. We've long understood the former point. After all, the conservative movement gave birth to Trump. As for the latter, Democrats have no one to blame for their fecklessness but themselves and their failure as a party created an opening through which Trump just walked in. Neoliberalism, the party's driving force, is toxic, and it has failed not only much of the United States but also much of the world, driving wealth into the hands of a few while leaving the rest to fight for themselves, for the crumbs, and people are sick of it. For decades, Democrats have been expanding their coalition, but in the wrong direction. Instead of strengthening their relationship with organized labor and building a platform sufficient to inspire and raise the expectations of working-class Americans, the so-called New Democrats, or the Third Way Democrats, devised a plan to win over the professionals, the so-called moderates. These so-called reformers wanted the party to become what it has, in fact, become. Lee Drutman called it the cosmopolitan elite party. And while this party still relies heavily on minority votes, its ability to deliver material benefits to this minority has been compromised and by its partnerships with corporate America and wealthy professionals who, even if they identify as liberals, couldn't care less about income and wealth inequality. But it's not just that they have left the working class in a state of stagnation. Democrats have done tremendous harm. A Democrat destroyed welfare. A Democrat signed the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, into law. A Democrat, at the behest of the business class, tore down much of what was left of the regulatory apparatus like Glass-Steagall or the Future Commodities Trading Act that was tenuously restraining the financial sector. When it all came crashing down in 2008, a president who proposed change we can believe in staffed his entire transition team with Wall Street lobbyists and loyalists. President Obama has also, against the fierce protests of those who once claimed to be fighting for, aggressively pushed for a far-reaching trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that is, in part, a power grab by massive corporations. Move ahead to the present, and you'll see that these trends have only accelerated. Hillary Clinton was a near unanimous hit among the Democrat establishment, chosen as the ideal presidential candidate before she had formally announced her intentions to run. She had at her command the biggest money-making operation in history, and her ties to corporate America were far deeper and stronger than President Obama's. Her path to the White House was, it seemed, rather clear. And then a genuine progressive came along and messed everything up. Bernie Sanders put forward an ambitious agenda that affirmed goals the Democratic Party was previously happy in word only to champion, from a $15 minimum wage to free public college tuition to universal health care, and he garnered striking enthusiasm from a remarkably diverse coalition. The response from the establishment was again nearly unanimous. Sanders is a great guy and all, the narrative went, but he could never win. His proposals were, said the punditry and the high-ranking Democrats, in a synchronous torrent of takes and assessments, insufficiently pragmatic, and dismissed Bernie Sanders out of hand because he just wasn't plausible in his arguments. Given his scandal-free record, given his appeal among younger and otherwise inactive voters, he would be no match for Trump. But Sanders just denounced them and ignored what they had to say. As we have recently learned, and as we have long suspected, he was actively undermined. Hillary Clinton ultimately won the nomination, and the presidency, it seemed, was in sight. Republicans nominated an incompetent wrecking ball. The commentariat enjoyed a self-satisfying chuckle. Well, it was widely believed that Clinton would move right forward after the primaries, and all of her appointment lined up, and all of her sponsors, and all the people voting for her, and all the high-money people were all to the far right. Radical right. These are fascist in their entirety. Not one has any humanistic principles, in my personal opinion. But she had them all, and where was the media challenging it? Where were the people saying, hey, do you really have Donald Rumsfeld voting for you and George Bush Sr.? Really? Do you have all the heads of the big oil and hydrofracking, all the war machine, the war profiteers, all the bankers, all the insurance companies, the pharmaceutical companies, the big agriculture, Monsanto? Everyone's on your side. The media is complicit, adoring. And no one thought that somehow that didn't represent democratic ideals. She had money from the unions on her side, but show me once where she actually went out and fought on behalf of the unions. Now, maybe I missed it, and I could have. But when we were demonstrating in dozens of marches across America, march against Monsanto, march against Indian Point, march against the pharmaceuticals industry's price gouging, marching against psychiatrists, pathologizing children's behavior by giving them titles that didn't match anything in the children's life, like social anxiety disorders that can sell them a product. Surely Hillary was there, right? She was locking arms with Bill McKibben and others and getting herself arrested. Surely Bill and her both were out there getting themselves arrested. With all the noble causes that the Democrats support, can you name me one single demonstration in the Clintons' entire political history where they were arrested for standing up for what they expect others to do for them? No. And here we are. Now, here we are. But here's some really, really good news. Let me share the latest I have on a quote. Bernie Sanders, quote, build an independent democratic socialist left. Now I know that there are people, good and honorable people, people who are friends of mine, who believe the Democratic Party can be found. Don't. I believe that what we have got to do right now is create a progressive, independent political movement which brings together all the single-issue groups who are currently banging their heads against the wall, the unions, the minority groups, the women's organizations, the environmentalists, the senior citizens, the youth, the peace activists, and all the people who know that we need fundamental change in this country. End quote. Bernie Sanders. How about that? Oh, I'm sorry. June 22nd, 1989. Wow. 1989. Boy, those were good thoughts. So then, on June 22nd, he realized that the Democratic Party was corrupt, was totally controlled by special interest groups, and the neocons would not change. And therefore, he said, let's start a new movement. Well, had he looked at the Greens, they already had a good movement. They had formidable individuals. They had people who legitimately deserve Humanitarian of the Year, Humanitarian of the Decade, like Ralph Nader. No human being in American history has ever done as much on the political stage to protect our rights than has he. And then we had Jill Stein carrying on that tradition. But they were marginalized and given no credit. So what happened to Bernie? What happened, Bernie? You brought all these young idealists, the people who saw the corruption, the people who wanted something better. You brought them to the Democratic Party as if the party would change because of the desires, the needs of these people? No, Bernie, you're too smart for that. You know something that's been left out of this calculus? I don't have an answer today, but maybe Francis Boyle, writing from the Law Building in Champaign, Illinois, I just read this about an hour ago, he says, quote, for what it's worth, Bernie has permanently discredited and disqualified himself by backing Clinton to the bitter end. He cannot lead us, in my opinion. Jill Stein still can. What we don't understand is this. When it became clear that Bernie was winning and would have trounced Clinton in the primaries, and the media was working, 65 members of the mainstream media working against him, the entire Democratic apparatchiks in Washington were working against him. Hillary Clinton knew all this. Her campaign directors, all the people around her knew this because WikiLeaks shows this. Then he should have at that moment called for a redo. He should have told the whole world, this is not right. I'm telling these people that we can change the world, How can we change the world if what I'm allowing to come into, insisting to come into, is itself corrupt? And then after he found out it was corrupt, after he was made aware that everyone he was championing, including Hillary Clinton, had reneged on any sense of ethics, that, in my opinion, is when he should have stopped everything, held a national press conference, said, up until this moment, until these revelations, I would have been willing to have accepted the outcome. Now I realize the outcome is rigged. And therefore, we're going to demand a redo, and we're going into the court system in California, New York, and other places where we know it was rigged. That would have shown a champion of the people. So there's a piece of the calculus that we're missing. What it is, I cannot tell you at this moment, and I do not want to speculate. But I have my own thoughts about those who are mourning, those who are blaming, those who are screaming, and those who are insisting that our poor Hillary. Well, maybe they're right. So maybe the corporate liberal Democratic Party should nominate Hillary Clinton for Humanist of the Year. That would be a good consolation prize, right? Back in a moment for my comments. I'm going to give you my insights on this issue. Let's say that you're right. Let's say this massive moment is right now. Michael Moore's right. Let's all join together and take back the Democratic Party. What exactly are you taking back? Will you go in and purge every single one of the political appointments? Will you purge every single person that has a financial conflict of interest by representing the special interest groups? Will you still hold Hillary Clinton in the same regards as somehow she has been defeated by this evil Trump and by stupid Americans, the deplorables, and based upon her other comments, things that should never be mentioned about people, denigrating them? You may be right. But understand, until you're honest about the person that you chose to be president and supported for president, then you are equally culpable. So before you blame the American public and denigrate them for the choices they made, including more people, 48% of people chose not to vote. And these are not a bunch of illiterate, rednecks, racists, homophobes. You would like to project that. To the contrary, these are people who are extremely concerned. But maybe they see that they cannot hold their nose and vote for someone, especially if they have a history. Let me share the history of Clintons, and you have to say Clintons because it's a tag team match, and they both take responsibility for their humanitarian efforts. And these are a matter of historical fact. The Clintons assured the brutal dictatorships are a viable form of government. They promoted it constantly, compatible with democracy around the globe. Not a republic, but remember, we don't have a democracy. We're supposed to have a republic, but we don't actually have a republic. They ignored the international war crimes of Paul Kagame in Rwanda. During that, it was one of the most devastating genocides in history for a 90-day period, over 900,000 dead, 2 million all told, mostly Tutsis. Its former nationalist president was assassinated in a plane crash just before the genocide. And our president of the United States, Bill Clinton, was fully aware of that. Clinton regarded dictator President Mubarak in Egypt, quote, a close personal friend. And as a result, he made sure that he got at least $1.3 billion military aid annually, and that anything that they needed in order to better search, arrest, detain, destroy, kill any dissenters, including young idealist students, so be it. So I went back and decided to look at all the scientific literature about the methods of torture, detention, and the justification for it to our State Department. You will not see the mainstream media once pointing to the Clintons' support for this genocidalist in Egypt. But then again, he was not alone. I guess the Clintons were using humanitarian compassion with a slight twist, and it was shown in Iraq in economic sanctions responsible for anywhere at the low end, 500,000 to the more realistic end of 675,000 dead Iraqi children. This was Clinton's war. And in fact, when Madeleine Albright was asked on 60 Minutes in front of the world audience watching that by Leslie Stahl, and keep in mind, she was secretary of or ambassador at the UN for many years, and she was the ambassador when Kagame and his brutal group were hacking people to death with machetes, and the UN's head in Rwanda at the time had multiple complaints about how every time he tried to stop the genocide, he was told to stand down by the UN. And the UN was influenced directly by our White House. And also there were many people in the State Department who said there's genocide, and the Clintons refused to accept it because then they would have to have done something about it. On an upcoming program, I'll do a complete one-hour special from people who are actually behind the investigations from the International Criminal Court to show you what actually happened, who was involved, and the United States, the State Department, the CIA were all over the genocide in Rwanda. But again, I'm willing to hear if you have an argument that this was a humanitarian genocide and humanitarian and benevolent position towards Mubarak, and that your sanctions, though I read the specific part of the Geneva Convention that says that you cannot bomb a facility that is used for the public if that would take away some quality of life. For example, you can't bomb a water treatment facility because then they would be dying of sepsis and other types of contaminated water. And that was the whole idea, because documents released from the Freedom of Information from the Defense Department showed that they actually intended to do this. This was with intent, so that the public would get so angry at all their children dying that they'd rise up against Saddam Hussein. Well, Saddam Hussein had the money to have water purifications at all of his palaces and all of his army and all of his military and all of his high-end society and scientists. They all had no problem with food or water. But the poor, between 500,000 to 675,000, they didn't have pure water, so they died. That was specifically and exclusively, I guess, a humanitarian intervention by Hillary Clinton. Again, Democrats are very, very good at justifying anything, so I'm sure they can spin that. And also, the Clintons actually stated, quote, "We have a humanitarian bombing," that was their words, not mine, "of Operation Allied Force carried out through NATO, destroying Yugoslavia. 250,000 Kosovos killed, Kosovo Albanians, they were driven into exile or homeless. Massacres and mass graves still being uncovered to this day. 78% of the casualties were non-combatants." Oh, and by the way, did anyone mention in the newspaper that the head of Yugoslavia at the time, who was arrested, tried on war crimes, was found innocent of all those charges? No. All right. Other dictatorships that the Clintons not just supported, but promoted: the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia, the House of Thani in Qatar, the Alawite dynasty in Morocco, the Idris Deby of Chad, the Oweri in Uganda, the Ali Sala in Yemen, the Mobutu Siko in the Congo, the Zine El Abidine Ben Ali of Tunisia. And in every case where there was students uprising, where poor people were standing up and demanding food, we, the United States, through our national security agencies, CIA, and the White House, including through their White House, when she was Secretary of State or earlier, they made sure they had the weapons to put down those people. Again, I guess that was a humanitarian squelching of public dissent. But we also saw the Clintons support the dictatorships of the Hamad bin Isa al-Khalafi of Bahrain, the new Sultan of Kazakhstan, the Rahman of Tajikistan, the Ismail Omar Kula of Djibouti, also with Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, she promoted and supported Turgon Tang Sang of Vietnam, a dictator, the head of Turkmenistan, the Petro Poroshenko of Ukraine, the Mikhail Saakashvili of Georgia, the Michael Martley of Haiti, who supported a coup that Clinton was behind to oust Aristide. And Aristide was a democratically elected official, but it was under Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton that they got rid of him. And they assured that poverty of extreme magnitude featured prominently in the American landscape. Bill Clinton's humanitarian efforts towards those on welfare in 1996 doubled extreme poverty for those of color while he was in office. So you're talking about 1.6 million people who were no longer had money to feed their children. Almost all were people of color, the majority were. But then those are the same people that he and his wife would go back and say, we're your friends. That's either a very severe case of Stockholm Syndrome or it's a gestalt. According to Francis Fox Priven, who I spoke to on this, Bill Clinton adapted this bill primarily on Hillary's advice, and that was to double the extreme poverty while in office and launched an American apartheid targeting African Americans through a private prison system where over 50% incarcerated are black and imprisoned for minor criminal offenses such as possession of small quantities of marijuana, yet 65% of drug users and peddlers are white. Only 13% are black, 17% are Latino. Also, we have to look at their humanitarian efforts at uplifting millions of poor whites and minority Americans by slashing social services. I guess that's one way you can look at, you know, a humanitarian effort. If you take someone who's really poor and hungry, who's homeless, well, show them that if you make them even more poor, take away many of their services and ignore them, surely they'll be able to get on their feet and say, thank you, Jesus, for helping us. Yeah, I guess there are some people that. And the Clintons pioneered in education by standardized tests to assure young people have increased thinking and as worker bees, what George Carlin is suggesting there, to help a prospering plutocracy. And consistently supported policies and bills and executive acts when she was either in the State Department or as senator to strengthen the military-industrial complex, to strengthen the intelligence gathering complex, and to take that money away from social services and human developments throughout there. And she supported the Patriot Act, surveillance of citizens, increase the budgets for the war chest. She supported invading Afghanistan and Iraq by murdering Gaddafi and destroying Libya. But that's, again, put it in perspective. If you're not in Libya and you're not watching news on Libya, and if you do watch the news on Libya, you're only going to see our courageous freedom fighters and Hillary Clinton saying, we're bringing democracy back. That's the important story, right, New York Times? Right, Anderson Cooper and the people overseeing it? That's what you want to put. You don't want to show 50,000 dead Libyans. You don't want to show 2 million displaced and homeless. You don't want to show the country that was number one in education, number one in healthcare, number one in women's rights, number one in democratic principles, number one in sharing the wealth of its oil, number one in promoting the gold denier as a standard of new currency exchange throughout Africa. You don't want to show that they had no crime. No. I mean, if you did that, then someone, maybe one liberal in the United States, there might be one liberal in the United States, would say, hold on a second. Why in the hell are you bombing and destroying a country that represents no threat, that is the most prosperous country, longest lifestyle, longest lifespan, highest level of literacy, 88.3% in Africa? Why would you destroy them? that's not the story you're going to cover, right, New York Times? You're going to cover, we came, and he died, and laugh about it. And then the entire corporate left can laugh along with it. See, she's got experience. She has experience. You bet. Shame on me for challenging the type of experience she has. Why wouldn't I get in line with all the other corporate liberal Democrats and say, wow, this is a party we should belong to and we should take it back? But then the same mindset went into supporting Al-Qaeda and making them the new Syrian freedom fighters. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.